the show where I, Josh Pigford, founder of Bearmetrics, hop on a call with other founders and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Zach Klein, founder of Vimeo and DIY. In this episode, we talk about the origin stories and how Zach got involved with College Humor, Busted Tees, Vimeo, DIY.org, and Jam. How Zach started an online reptile pet store as a high school kid, and how everything he's done has a common thread that ties back to his days spent on AOL growing up, and a lot more. Hope you enjoy. Hey, Zach, how's it going?
Hey, Josh. Really well, thanks.
Right on. Well, cool. Well, thanks for hopping on a call. The way that I like to start these things off with is like going all the way back to the beginning. So you as a kid, what were you like as a kid?
My mom likes to recall that I used to carry a briefcase filled with watercolors, and I would try to sell them to my family.
So wait, was it because you were interested in watercolor or like painting, or was it just you interested in selling something?
My dad was a small business owner, and I was just, you know, he was sort of my hero, and he carried a briefcase to work, and I think that planted a seed for me. But you know, I think I've been hustling in some form or another since then.
Sure. I guess at some point, when did you get your first computer?
Funny. So one day I came home from school. I was like 11, and my parents told us that we were moving from upstate New York to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and like they like bribed us with a couple of things. They finally said they'd get us a dog, and they'd finally get us a computer. So a few months after moving to Indiana, I got my first computer and my first subscription to AOL. And it, you know, obviously changed my life overnight. Back in those days, AOL had this really cool free piece of software called AOL Press that was a WYSIWYG editor, but it allowed you to tap on any element and see the underlying code. And I actually felt like it was ahead of its time. You could copy and paste HTML from any other pages in your browser, you know, paste it into the WYSIWYG editor, and then, you know, tap on each object really easily to see sort of like an element inspector, mm-hmm. and see how everything worked. And I've been hooked ever since then.
Well, you know, moving from New York to Indiana, especially as an 11-year-old, I assume was kind of a tough move.
No, actually, they didn't have to bribe me too much.
Really?
I'm really fond of upstate New York, but I wanted adventure, and I didn't really, you know, I had no expectations for what Indiana would be like, and just sort of like an exciting event like that. I just found really interesting for us all to sort of pick up and learn about and find a new place.
Sure.
And the place the school district we moved into was great. It was like, it was just one of those like public school systems that was put together really well. And if you didn't have a personal computer at home, the school district lent you one, and kids were required to hand in homework on discs. And, I remember in a social studies course, we got to spend like 2 weeks building cities in SimCity. It felt like so far and beyond what I was used to. Yeah.
So you mentioned SimCity. I mean, like, were you into games at all as a kid?
Yeah. I mean, I think I could section out 2 or 3 years of my childhood in SimCity alone. That was so much for me.
I would, my buddy and I would stay up, like, you know, we'd hang out over the weekend and just stay up for multiple nights in a row. And we'd get graph paper and pre-plan our cities, like sketch them out on just tape together graph paper before we started building.
I remember doing that too.
Yeah. Super nerdy. So I guess for you was AOL, I think a lot of time, people who weren't around for like early AOL years, it was almost this such a well put together sort of built in community almost, because so much of it revolved around chat rooms, and it was this very like self-contained thing that was like ready to use right out of the box. Did you meet many people online that like you stayed in touch with over the years from using AOL?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing that I, if the like sort of, I can't recall the taxonomy of AOL exactly. I guess they had channels, and then certain channels had chat rooms, but there were also like, they had, some of them had boards where there were like, there were these non-chat areas where you could post stuff. And I think there was like a design or an art and design section, and they had this really cool resource for people who were building web pages where anyone could post, you know, like a graphic object that other people could download it to use on their websites. And that's like where I first discovered GIFs. Yep. And that's where I first started dabbling in graphic design. I remember like going to the bookstore and ripping off from the front cover of one of like the computer magazines, a demo disc for Adobe Photoshop LE. And, you know, it had just like really limited functionality, but enough for you to like make graphics. And then I started contributing to AOL that way. I would make, you know, buttons, and upload them and, really just get a thrill out of seeing other people download them and use them on their web pages. And that's, for me, it was just like, I think in a way I've still been chasing, you know, my entire internet career. I've been, you know, trying to recreate that very first experience with the internet where there was just, there was so much generosity. There was just so much interest, mutual interest in, you know, among everyone who was involved to see what this could do. And, you know, the motivations just felt really pure, you know, especially, yeah. I mean, at least from my perspective as an 11-year-old who is like dabbling on AOL, it just seemed like we were all in it for just how cool it could be.
Yeah, totally. I think, and I agree completely where, you know, that whole generosity element where, nobody was trying to get anything out of anything other than to like figure out how the whole internet thing even worked, you know? During this time while you're building stuff, you know, random websites and graphics and things like that, was there any sort of business component? Like, were you trying to make money off of this at all, or trying to, you know, churn out little business ideas?
No, I didn't. You know, I was, this whole time I had offline businesses. Like I was selling, you know, like wrapping paper door to door, and I was delivering newspapers, and, you know, it hadn't even entered my mind that I could make money on the web. And I didn't really try until, late in high school when sort of like I was sort of calculating the difference between what I could afford and what college cost, and realized that I need to come up with a difference fast. So, you know, and this is around 1999. So the dot-com boom was in full swing, and, I tried to sort of like, you know, as a 16, 17 year old, I tried to figure out how I could get paid to make web pages. And then there's a long, but not necessarily interesting story to it, but bottom line is right before I went off to college, I created a online pet store called The Reptile Shack, and I sold exotic reptiles and amphibians and supplies online, and that's basically how I earned money through college.
Well, so I mean, how would the logistics there? Did you have the actual stuff at your house, or were you basically reselling it?
Yeah. So there was a kid, this was spurred by a biology teacher who had kept snakes in our classroom. And he was telling us, that, you know, it was expensive for him because he had to you know, buy mice, to feed them. And so my buddy and I started like breeding mice for him. And then we just became interested in like, you know, are there other people who would want to buy these mice? And then we sort of became like familiar with people who sort of collected and raised, you know, snakes, reptiles, amphibians. And then we learned that there was, there's just a few breeders in the country that like are responsible for stocking most pet stores. So then what I did is they were mostly, enterprise, just, selling directly to franchise pet stores. And so I contacted them and worked out a deal where they would drop ship. I would represent their catalog through a website that I built, and they would drop ship my orders.
Got it, man.
Which was pretty cool, because if you've ever been sitting in a window seat, on the tarmac of like a Delta flight, and you look over, to the baggage loader, sometimes you'll see boxes that say, live animals. Fish and fit. Yeah. Pet store stuff actually gets shipped, in the belly of commercial aircraft. Right.
That's fun stuff. So what happened to the reptile shack?
I just became interested in other things. I got to college and met, people who were like other people who were working online. I went to Wake Forest in North Carolina, pretty small school, and there weren't too many of us. I'd say, probably a dozen or less who were running some sort of business online, and we all hung out with each other. And one of those guys, his name is Ricky Van Veen. And he's the founder of College Humor, him and his buddy, Josh Abramson. And I eventually became involved in their business. They were non-technical, non-product oriented. They were sort of like a business and content duo. And I got involved, helping to run the product development for them. And then that basically trumped everything else that I was working on. While I was in school, we built Busted mm-hmm. Tees, which became this big t-shirt company. And then we had saved enough money. Our goal was to save enough money to afford living in New York together after college for 1 year. And we were going to give ourselves 1 year in New York to sort of like make it happen for us.
So, I mean, all of the founding people or I guess initial people that worked on College Humor were at Wake Forest?
No, just Ricky and me. And then Josh was at the University of Richmond, and Jake was at Rochester Institute of Technology in upstate New York.
I mean, what was the connection that you guys had? Was it just met on the internet kind of thing?
No, Jake, Ricky, and Josh were all from the same town in Maryland. Okay. So they had, it was a motley sure. crew. Like there were two of them had known each other in high school, three of them from the same town. Ricky and I were in the same college. I think that's just in the early days, and this is still 2000. Oh no, I mean, sorry. This would have been like 2002. There was still a relatively small number of people who were, building stuff on the web. So it's sort of knitted together this way. Somebody had a friend or knew somebody, and you all sort of just merged, until you had enough talent on hand to make the thing.
And I assume, College Humor grew or blew up pretty fast, or was it College, did it come first, or the Busted Tees first?
College Humor came first. So College Humor, sort of rose with the advent of like broadband at home and in colleges. I think that was sort of like an interesting time for teenagers. Is like most people like around 2000 were, still had dial up at home. And so when they got to college, it was their first experience or their first taste of broadband. And so video sharing and music sharing became really common once you got into school. I mean, it was feasible. So it was really, college kids who were circulating the first viral videos, because it was so easy for them to do amongst their dorms. So College Humor really just rode that wave of broadband emerging, and there being these pockets of kids around the country who were sharing videos with each other, and it became the repo for viral video at the time. And then the market crashed, and the ad market in particular crashed, and a lot of businesses online that were driven by ad revenue had to scramble to diversify, or they went out of business. And so what we did was, and this is really how I got involved, is Josh and Ricky were, you know, had the foresight to anticipate that they should diversify away from ad revenue. And what they did is they looked at their perennial advertisers and sort of ranked the businesses that they could imitate themselves. So, you know, some of their largest advertisers were people who were making products, you know, marketing to college kids, t-shirts being a huge one. And so, you know, my first big project with the company was building Busted Tees. And then what we did is we just replaced all of the ad inventory on College Humor with ads for Busted Tees, and College Humor is largely supported that way through t-shirt sales.
That's cool. So what, I mean, as a college, or I guess fresh out of college at that point, kid, I mean, what was, you know, you mentioned it was like you sort of rode the wave of all these college kids getting broadband. I mean, did it feel like you were riding a wave, like that there was this thing that was growing really fast and it was really exciting?
Yeah, I can't believe it hasn't been that long, but it is incredible how quickly things have changed. I still have this, like, I have this journal that I kept at the time where, around that time I was contemplating what I would do after graduation, because having a career working on the internet did not seem possible from my point of view, even though, like, you know, I was doing it nights and weekends while balancing college. There was just so much pessimism about the internet as a viable career, or even as a viable commercial enterprise, that it seemed like only a few people could really participate in it and make a livelihood from it. So, you know, I was considering all kinds of things, and so now, yeah, of course, you know, 15 years later, it's just phenomenal to see just how saturated it has become and how easy it is to, you know, make a living on the internet.
So what was the transition? I mean, you were at College Humor and Busted Tees for 4 or 5 years or something like that, and then it kind of started doing other things, or how long did that go on?
No, so the cool thing was that, you know, I think there were four of us partners, and we called ourselves Connected Ventures, and we all had vastly different interests, you know, with, you know, some overlap in the middle. And so we moved to New York. We got a little bit more serious at, you know, by the time we got to New York, you know, around 2005, the ad market had begun to, like, swing back up, and, College Humor could grow a little bit more on its own and support its own staff. So, you know, we grew like a pretty modern, you know, ad sales division, and started that could support us bringing on, you know, producing our own original content. So we brought, you know, we built a writing team, and which is really sort of amazing to behold in hindsight, because a lot of those writers have gone on to very successful careers, writing for, you know, SNL and John Oliver. This sort of time and place in College Humor's history was a sort of meaningful cradle for a lot of comedy writers. And so I got to watch that, and that was really neat to be part of. But so College Humor sort of got up on its own and was sort of running itself. And there was all these people, you know, me, Jake, Josh, Ricky, that had a lot of passion and interest to make things on the web. So we sort of gave ourselves a license to work on, you know, to find new opportunities. So, and that was pretty diverse. Like, Ricky was really interested in understanding Hollywood and getting involved in production. So he was working on a project to create an original College Humor movie. And, Jake had always been really interested in video. He had been sort of like amateur filmmaker his entire life, you know, since a child. And, he prior to sort of like the video sharing phenomenon, he was producing, editing and publishing really, really complex and beautiful video blogs. And I was really passionate about the about Flickr. Flickr was like a game changer on the internet for me. That was probably like, you know, after AOL, Flickr was like a the next major sort of social milestone for me on the internet. Just being part of a community around something that I was really passionate about. And so Jake had started working on a project where he would, you know, I think what he was trying to solve for was he was making these, like, he would make these video blogs that would take him several weeks to sort of produce and edit. And I think he was looking to cut, like, just sort of like find a shortcut so that he could post video to the internet more frequently, and for the sort of like consuming experience to be a little bit more ad hoc. So he had started working on a concept where he would just start uploading video clips to a service that he had made, and then that service allowed him to tag those clips, and then allowed visitors to just sort through these video clips by tag and watch streams of them. He and I just sort of came together around that idea, and I think I brought my perspective as a sort of like power user of Flickr, and I applied a lot of the things I'd picked up on Flickr to what he was working on, and then from there, sort of, you know, the Vimeo as we know it was born.
So okay, so what was the landscape like as far as video stuff goes? I mean, what year was this that you guys launched Vimeo?
Yeah, so this was. So, I mean, the project began informally in 2004, and then I think in like, you know, summer of 2005, it really became, Jake and I got a sort of green light from our partners to start working on it full time. And because there was a lot coming together all at once that made it possible. So, the flip cam had just come out and was being sold in Walgreens. So this was like a way for that consumers could easily record video. And then also Flash was updated to support video streaming. So just like in that one, you know, in like a 6-month period, like the sort of like, you know, the supply problem and the like the tech delivery problem was solved. And an explosion of, you know, of video streaming, video hosting solutions emerged. I believe Vimeo preceded YouTube. And the stories of the two, I think, are a really, I think, a pretty fascinating sort of explanation of the dichotomy between New York and San Francisco at that time. We were based in New York, and YouTube was based in the Bay Area. And at that time in New York, the sort of VC world was very small, and there was virtually few options for early stage companies. Some of the classics were around then, like Union Square Ventures and Fred Wilson, but they were investing in, like, from my perspective, mostly in companies that were at the growth stage. And we pitched a lot of folks in New York about this, you know, video sharing idea. And you know, the basic advice we got was that this was never going to be a direct to consumer business. It was going to be a feature, and we should, you know, merge with somebody who could use our tech that we had built to create a sort of enterprise solution. And meanwhile, in California, I think the YouTube folks, they were ex PayPal. They were just so well connected to a capital network, and their investors, their advisors were telling them, you know, basically like, you know, grab every viral video you can, whether you have like the rights to it or not, like just, you know, grab viewership, and don't worry about the server bills. Meanwhile, you know, we were basically, we had zero investment, and we were paying for everything out of pocket. So we actually had to place a cap on how much video could be uploaded by each user. And if a video became too popular, we actually had to take it down because we couldn't afford for video to be popular. We didn't have a way to monetize the video, and a viral video would basically break us for the month. We couldn't afford it. So this really fascinating divergence happened where we YouTube chased the stuff that was that was massively popular, and we stayed in personal video. We focused on people who were interested in making video themselves that was not intended for a large audience. It was intended for a small social group that they sort of had handpicked, that's sort of, those two paths sort of.
So I'm curious about that today. Where, you've got this forced limitation based on really your budget or the sort of economics of it. But at the same time, it also sends you down that path of, YouTube's always been sort of this felt a little, I don't know. It's so all over the place. Full range of anything and everything gets uploaded to YouTube. Whereas Vimeo always stuck out in my mind as the bar for quality was just exponentially higher. Did it bother you guys that you really couldn't afford to go have some video get amazingly popular or just post anything under the sun on there? Or did you like the fact that there was those limitations were in place?
No, of course. I mean, of course we wish that we had that we could have the platform that was massively popular. We didn't see a dichotomy between having everything and also having really high quality special stuff. We thought they could live on one place. And it was it was a very frustrating experience. We thought that we believed that it was inevitable for this platform to become a platform like what we are building to become massively popular. And it was just a matter of who could get the resources to build it. And I mean, by the way, this is playing out what we experienced plays out all the time, we weren't the first, to experience that sort of arms race. And we weren't the last. You look at Uber and Lyft today, it's while those are both at a massive scale, ultimately one's about, the challenge, the battle between the two is about who can get access to most capital. So, while we're happy with what we built, the legacy of Vimeo is something that, I'm very proud of. I guess another way to answer your question is I'm not sure that I could have built what YouTube is today, because we just made so many decisions that were really driven from a personal place. We were really driven to create something special that we felt sort of epitomized what the internet could be, echoing back to my comments earlier about AOL. And so we always took pride in, for example, in how you could take the same video you could compare the same video hosted on YouTube and on Vimeo, and there would just be vastly different comment feeds underneath those videos. YouTube's a dumpster fire, and on Vimeo you would experience a lot more constructive criticism, positive feedback, just kindness. And that was that was something that wasn't random. We designed for that, and we spent a lot of time, focusing on handpicking our early users and building this seed of a community that could sustain itself. That was happening at the same time that we were, we really wanted to raise money for this thing. But I wonder, even if we had access to the capital, whether we ever could have built YouTube, just because we were optimizing for all these other things that I don't think that, the YouTube founders were.
I think that ultimate results, you've got you and Jake's experiences that you bring to the table, whereas the founders of YouTube had their own things. And I think, I obviously there's the, YouTube becomes this cultural thing almost at this point. But I also think, you mentioned being proud of what you guys did at Vimeo. Do you think you would have been more or less proud had it turned into something like YouTube where it was that popular, but also it's like this sort of constant dumpster fire from a community aspect?
No, I mean, in hindsight today, no, I would be extremely proud to have, you know, to have Vimeo, you know, become something like YouTube. It's like, it is unfortunate the sort of the things that you experience on YouTube, but I also feel like YouTube to some extent is a more accurate reflection of people on Earth. You know, it's just like, it's more diverse. And those sorts of like social challenges and conflicts between people are something that like, as a community builder, you have to contend with. And YouTube is at such a different scale that they, you know, that there's, I think the dumpster fires are just going to be more conspicuous. You know, but you know, my respect for YouTube has definitely grown in the last 5 or 6 years since I've been working on my most recent projects, which are all focused on kids. And as I've been, you know, spent a lot of time studying how, you know, kids and families learn, it's, you know, I would argue that probably more learning is happening on YouTube than anywhere else. You know, more than any other tool that was designed specifically for learning. There's, you know, I think, you know, YouTube is just up there with like, you know, Wikipedia as sort of a database of like the world's knowledge base. And if you seek it, if you have the motives, I mean, if you know what to seek, you can find virtually anything on YouTube, and it's very easy to connect to people with skills and passion and know-how who can show you what you need to know. So, you know, I'm able to see it for what it is, and it's like, you know, it's if you have the right motives.
Do you think there's anything that, I mean, in hindsight, obviously, but that you would have done differently, like knowing what you know now?
You know, I think I don't, again, it's right. Like if we're in a vacuum, I mean, I think, Vimeo, you know, it's really hard to say, you know, if you're saying like, if the question is like, how, what would I have done differently to get Vimeo to YouTube scale? You know, I honestly think that Vimeo has to, would have to have grown up in the West Coast. I just think that there is a framework out in California in the Bay Area. I mean, at least at this time, you know, I'm talking about a very specific time period. Obviously, like different markets, you know, different scenes have become more sophisticated. But in 2005, 2006, there just weren't many places on Earth that had the concentration of access to capital and the sort of like mercenary class of a very like you know of developers with like very specific domain expertise necessary to build a video, you know, a video service like YouTube or Vimeo. And so when I said earlier, like YouTube had access to capital, that was just the first battle won, you know, but then like when you start thinking about the challenges of scaling a video service, and doing the amount of like transcoding and hosting that, YouTube does, it really helped them that they were out west where that sort of skill class already lived and could easily be recruited. You know, which was a challenge for us in New York. Like it was at that time, there was not a very large and sophisticated, developer class, that was familiar with like, you know, video streaming tech. So, you know, we, as a team, we had to learn a lot of this stuff on the fly. So, yeah. If I was transported back to 2005 and my challenge was to take Vimeo to YouTube scale, I think like I should have moved west. But we were really happy to be New Yorkers, and that was never really an option for us. And I'm very happy again with like where Vimeo turned out. I think it stands as a counterpoint to, you know, to everything that the West Coast does create. You know, it's a different point of view for like, you know, what an internet service can feel like. And, a lot of the things that Vimeo achieved, we take for granted now. I mean, that Vimeo was really a pioneer in its approach to community building, and it's like, and it's just its sensitivity to customers, to its its look and feel and cuddliness that I think has like come to define most services that have come after it. You know, if you use the Wayback Machine and go compare YouTube and Vimeo, like, you know, YouTube looked and felt and worked like a utility, and Vimeo was a place, and it had a point of view, and it had rules, and it had a voice. And I think that sort of that perspective on placemaking on the internet, I think has become a dominant strategy for building, you know, services now.
Yeah.
And by the way, and what I mean by that is I think that was largely informed by the sort of attitude of New York, which, you know, I think in some way is more connected to normals, you know, to regular people than the Bay Area is. There's like an incredible number of these companies. I don't have the right adjective. Sure. I don't want to say cuddly, but just human even. These companies that have come out of New York that I think stand as these really interesting counterpoints, mm-hmm. you know, like I'm thinking of Etsy, I'm thinking of Kickstarter, Tumblr, you know, these are companies, that I think, are unique as they
well,
are.
And I mean, I think, you know, I obviously can't speak to the founders of any of those other companies that you mentioned, but I mean, you think of like you mentioned your history of how, you know, like AOL and then like even Flickr being this sort of next step of like community and around the internet. And so like that leads you to create similar things because you have this strong connection with that. And then you think of like YouTube, where like the founders were from PayPal, which I feel is like also just YouTube. You think of it as like a utility, which I think is a really good description of that. But like PayPal also very much this utility. Right. And I think there's certainly places for both. Obviously there's different, one thing maybe becomes more popular, but also Vimeo becomes like that next step, like after Flickr, right? Like, so still the super important component to the like ecosystem. So what you guys are working on that for a couple of years and then IAC comes into the picture. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So, you know, basically, to set the scene, we are now in sort of like a reboot from the .com crash, and there's this sense that like things are getting really hot really quickly all over again, and you know, we're seeing our ad rates just skyrocket, and we still, I think, are all sort of shell shocked from what happened in the early 2000s, and my partners and me are wondering whether it's like a good time to get, like, you know, to take some of the value out of the companies we built, fearing that like the market would crash, we'd lose our ad revenue, and we'd have to start from scratch again. So we had more or less, I think, always. I'm not absolutely clear on this, because my partner Josh handled a lot of the inbound, but we always had some level of M&A interest. It was just a, like a constant stream, but once we sort of like, you know, felt the ad rates reaching an unreasonable rate, what we felt was unreasonable, we began to like take some of those calls more seriously. So, IAC wanted to acquire Connected Ventures. So that is College Humor, Busted Tees, Vimeo, like everything that the four of us had built together. And and so we worked out a deal. And I think it went through in 2007. I think that's when we sold the whole package.
What was it? I mean, you mentioned they were interested in Connected Ventures and sort of all that entailed. Like, what do you think it was? IAC is, I mean, almost, I don't know if conglomerate's the right word, but I mean, they have lots of properties that they have. I mean, was it just because it was like, hey, we can get lots of stuff in one go, or was there some sort of unifying thread?
I honestly have never, like, I don't think I've ever sussed out exactly what their strategy is. I mean, it could have simply have been, you know, we were New York based, so we were in their backyard, and there was like, obviously there was like some formula there that was working, because we were very affordably able to churn out these businesses, and we could, you know, build stuff in many different directions. So like maybe they saw that the team had a secret sauce. But also, you know, I think they also, you know, at this point, YouTube had sort of like had broken out, and it was clear that, you know, video was going to have a future after all. And in us, they had College Humor, which was successfully monetizing video, which, you know, was, I don't know, I can't recall like who else was doing that really well at the time, but, you know, we had built a pretty decent business, like, you know, selling ads against video views. And this is before sort of the pre-roll ad existed. So, you know, like, you know, maybe they felt that, you know, in us, they had found a team that was able to, like, you know, generate revenues from media views. And then, you know, maybe then they had this sort of outside, they had the option to participate in this video sharing thing that was still emerging in Vimeo. So my favorite part of that story was, at that time, Barry Diller had commissioned Frank Gehry to build this like sparkling kind of quasi Death Star building on the west side in New York, overlooking the Hudson River. It was just like this extraordinary spaceship looking thing. And we all sort of saw the, like, the writing on the wall, like we were going to be acquired by this, you called it a conglomerate. I think that's fair. I mean, they're basically just they are a conglomerate that just has, you know, countless holdings in all different, you know, industries, and their job is to make them more efficient and to, like, you know, refine the business models and flip them typically. So, you know, we went from like, we were all, the entire company was based in a loft, and that was one floor above where we lived, and it was a really eclectic, wonderful place to work. And we were like deathly afraid that they would make us move into this new building, you know, that was cubicled and surrounded by suits. And so we sort of made Barry Diller a video, basically begging him not to make us go to his building. And, you know, it just showed us sort of like, you know, it showed us and all of our vices and our bad habits. And like, we warned him that would probably get on his nerves. the video, I think, was really well, they were entertained and well received by it, and they granted us our wish. So they, instead of making us move into the new building, they gave us the budget to get our own space. So we upgraded to a bigger office, but we were autonomous.
So, I mean, I still think, like, this was what, the IAC acquired you guys in 2006?
Yeah, I'm sort of blanking. It's 2006, 2007, somewhere around there.
So, I mean, either way, it's like within 2 or 3 years of you guys working on this thing, and like videos, just this like sort of wild west, everything, or like a gold rush, really, of things taking off. I mean, like, that must have been a pretty intense couple of years.
I mean, it was definitely the fastest, like, I've never been in a faster lane, in my life than those 2 years. It was like my life just changed so radically, so quickly, just month after month after month. You know, like, graduated with a lot of college debt, had never expected to move to New York City, moved to New York City about 3 or 4 months after living in New York City. Rebecca Mead from the New Yorker magazine followed us around for a month and then wrote a profile about us that then led to us getting a book deal and a movie deal. And then with those advances, we could really invest in staff and get a new office. And like, suddenly we had to wear pants to work because we had employees and, you know, and just like, it just never stopped. And then it just sort of crescendoed with the sale. And, and this is something that, like, I think everyone, you know, my partners, I haven't officially asked them this, but I think a lot of us, I'll speak for myself, I know there's at least one other, you know, are sort of like, we do regret that we sold, but it was, I think, unavoidable at the time. One, we had like pretty good reason to think that we should like get out before the market crashes. Like, you know, most investors fail because they hold too long or they get greedy and like hold beyond what they like expected to return. So we thought we were being sensical by sort of like taking some chips off the table. You know, there is this like, you know, I'm not sure, for me growing up, like when I imagined like what success looked like, it, like, selling a company is about like the one of the most epic things you can do. Right. Like, it is an end in of itself. And so the fact that there was a publicly traded company that wanted to buy something that was like, and we were that we had made, and we were only 18 months out of college, was just like, it was just too irresistible. It just felt like that sort of like exclamation point on this like wild ride. You know, but I think, you know, for me in hindsight, it was like obviously like the market did eventually crash, you know, in 2007, 2008, yep. I guess like a year and a half later. But the recovery was swift. We probably would have weathered it. Obviously like video sharing never stopped, mm-hmm. you know, it's like its influence. It's a massive market. Vimeo, I think, is valued north of $1 billion now. Wow. You know, at least like internally in IAC's books. Yep. But I think for me, it actually had a lot less to do with like my regrets have a lot less to do with the monetary component, and it has a lot more to do with, just an extraordinary company that we had built, like the culture of people who, I mean, the people that we had on hand, and like just the diversity of our interests and our like high levels of like trust and, just the ability to have fun at work. It was just a really special group of people that I enjoyed being a part of. And, I would have liked to keep going with them. But after we were acquired, you know, like every founder sort of faces that dilemma with, you know, like, you know, how long do you stay on? You know, because I really do see my place in the food chain as, you know, I thrive in the startup phase. And so I didn't really know like how happy or productive I could be in an environment that was largely about, operating and refinement. So I think after a year and a half, I took off and, you know, I had to start from scratch, building a new team, finding a new area of focus, to sort of comply with my non-recruit, non-compete, clauses.
So how did that transition? I mean, the next thing after you left IAC was ultimately starting DIY, but like, what was in between that time?
So in between that time was, moving out of the city. So I just like, you know, one thing that was, you know, one of the, I think I didn't mention this earlier, but one of the, you know, more compelling reasons that I wanted to leave IAC was that I never got involved with the internet because I wanted to work on the internet. I got involved with the internet because, like, you know, I thought it was one of those historic moments in industry where, you know, people like me with relatively nothing could, you know, could be involved in and do something big and earn something big. You know, I had earned enough money that I, like, the things I'd always wanted to do were now attainable. Like, I just wanted to like spend a lot of time outside and, live someplace beautiful, naturally beautiful. So I never really desired to live in a city. And although it was incredible, I mean, my years in New York are just, you know, some of the best of my life. I just decided I wanted to move out of the city. So I bought some land in upstate New York, about 2 hours north, and it had a single cabin on it. And I worked out a schedule where I was there 3 or 4 nights a week. And my then girlfriend, now wife, stayed in our apartment full time because she was, running a design agency in New York. I just basically lived out in the woods and, you know, invited people to join me from time to time to work on projects. And that sort of coalesced into this thing that we call Beaverbrook, which is, there's a group of us still to this day that spend time on this property and, you know, practice new skills together. And it was that experience that sort of caused me to transition into creating DIY.org.
Did it, I mean, Were you even looking to start something new, or were you just sort of like you went out to the woods and just if something hit you, it hit you, but otherwise you were gonna keep chilling?
Yeah, I actually had zero desire to work on the internet. I actually like moved to this small town that didn't have like, you know, that had like a fairly small resident base, like less than 500 people, and like the four corners wasn't much of anything. And I had this idea that like I just wanted to sort of get involved in a small town. And, you know, maybe buy a local business and, you know, just, you know, be right. Local. But, you know, I also like, I imagined that I would do stuff online. Like I wanted to keep working as sort of like a creative online, but I didn't expect it to be venture-based. I wanted to be just, you know, I think my interests were more just creative / artistic / sort of doing it because I wanted to, not because I was like driven for a business model. So just a lot happened. I went out to San Francisco to go to this thing called Foo Camp, which is an annual event hosted by Tim O'Reilly, where he invites a few hundred people out to an apple orchard behind the O'Reilly offices in Marin County, and that 300 people sort of plan within like a 2 or 3 hour time span. They plan a conference, a 3 day conference, and you attend this sort of improvised conference that takes place in like tents. And I gave a talk about my ideas around what sort of offline communities the online generation will create once they sort of inherit the earth. Like all these kids that are growing up on the internet and learning how to behave and developing their passions through online services, what will it be like when we become, you know, when we become homeowners, when we become mayors, when we control the legislature, how will our online like learnings and our online livelihoods and lifestyles, how will that influence the kind of places that we want to build offline? And so I gave a talk on that, and I met some filmmakers who from California who had a very Beaverbrook like place just south of San Francisco, and they were like much further along than me. They had like buildings, and they had like a pretty like well-run garden that was feeding them, and they were working on paid creative projects, and they had this like, it just felt like a prototype for what a future sort of like technical community based in the woods could be like. And that was really what I was after. I was really interested in this, like in the fallacy that to work on big, important technical stuff, you have to live in a city. Because I saw one of the like features of the internet as the sort of untethering of cities and natural resources to make a livelihood. I like this idea that you could really choose an environment that made you happiest and still participate in a global economy, still participate in the knowledge economy. And they were doing it. So I went and spent a lot of time with them, just learning about them, learning about their projects, and it was with them that that DIY.org was born.
So, but I mean, that did that ultimately bring you back into the city?
So funny thing. So, I mean, at this time, I was still like getting things spinning up at Beaverbrook, and I was really passionate about it. But I just felt like I had met a tribe of people that like I really could learn from. And so my interest was to move to their sort of project in California and work with them. But my sort of like us spinning up DIY.org just created a conversation between me and my wife and them and their significant others about like, you know, if we're going to work on this project, where do we want to do it? And it turns out that, you know, that a lot of the people in the California project had their own stirrings to return to the city. So we all sort of compromised that like that San Francisco would be like, a, you know, would be sufficient. For me, it felt like It didn't, like, having lived in New York, it didn't feel like a city, although it, you know, it certainly is. To me, it just, like, it was a pretty good combination of both worlds, because it, you know, you wake up every day here and like, you know, like the fog is just like, is a monster just looming over the hills, and you can smell the ocean and you can hear the fog horns, and like, you're surrounded by water. The weather is just like, allows outdoor play all year long. So it was, I felt like I was getting the best of the city, but also getting what I really wanted was just like access to a beautiful place outside. And so I agreed to do it.
So DIY.org gets, you guys had this idea for it. I mean, is the impetus for it that you felt like you needed to like pass on something to future generations, or was it just wanting to, like, what made you guys want to go specifically after helping kids, you know, be hands-on with things?
Yeah. So the origin story of DIY is interesting. It's not straightforward. So the filmmakers had actually just completed a music video for Bjork that had received a lot of attention. It was sort of claymation in 3D, and they're sort of like, their inbox was getting filled with, you know, different proposals, different offers to direct films. And they decided that they want to use their sort of like 15 minutes of fame to like as leverage to direct a feature that they wrote. And so they had this idea to create a movie called DIY. And it was about these kids living in the near future, like 10 years out in a Rust Belt town that's devastated by a storm. And by this time in history, you know, all the adults in the world are sort of like addicted to a virtual reality and are pretty useless in the real world. And the kids sort of, you know, save the day by skilling up as they need to. So, this is what they were sort of working on when I met them. And together we came up with this idea that, there could be that, like, the kids' sort of like superpower in this film could be a sort of like their own dark web that they had built, that was like separate from the adult internet, in which kids were sort of like freely exchanging information that allowed them to more easily, like, you know, problem solve. And we pitched this to different, you know, different production teams, and JJ Abrams and Bad Robot said yes. So the filmmaker partners, they started working with JJ's team on the film, and I raised money for a digital company that was affiliated with the film that would, you know, ultimately benefit from the film's like popularity, but also, you know, eventually have its own business model. And the construct of DIY is that it's, you know, it's a sort of like, it's part social network, part learning platform for kids, where kids can freely share anything, but we're sort of inspired them to go in different directions using the skill framework that we had built, where we help them learn, you know, our goal is virtually any skill by showing them the sort of staircase of challenges that they need to overcome to learn that skill.
So how do you get, I mean, how do you, does the movie, did it get made?
Yeah. So we worked on that for about 2 years, and the movie did not get picked up by a studio. So we exercised an option to take back our IP, and we started collaborating with Cartoon Network on an animated series, and the sort of pilot episodes for that series were delivered late last year, and we're expecting them to go to sort of market testing any day now. So there's still something that could happen there.
So then how did the I don't know if product isn't really the right word, but I mean the community DIY.org and all the content around that, how did that end up coming to light if you didn't have sort of this movie that you had initially sort of been tying it into?
Well, and so that was the biggest challenge, is that the startup was largely premised on the idea that this film would happen in fairly short order. And so it was built to sort of receive like the, you know, the visitors from like that, like from that massively popular fan base that we hoped to grow through the film. So when the film didn't happen and, you know, that, that piece of the, like, of the formula was missing, we, you know, I had to look for, you know, for a business model that would help DIY.org sustain. So we, what we saw was, we saw, you know, when we like, we sort of surveyed our user base, and at this point in time, maybe we had like 400,000 or 500,000 kids, or, you know, 400,000 or 500,000 families participating in DIY. We started just testing out different, you know, different services that we could layer on top of DIY. And one of the things that we sort of like landed on, that tested really well was just giving kids, or families, longer form, more in-depth video to help them learn, particularly popular topics. And so we spun out another business called Jam, jam.com. And what this is really tapping into is just like the explosion of screen time for kids. You know, the average 3 to 8 year old in America is spending 45 minutes just on mobile video a day now. And there's a lot of trepidation at home about this. You know, parents on one hand understand that their kids need to be technically savvy to like to thrive in the future job economy, but they also aren't really sure that time spent on YouTube is productive or healthy for them. So, you know, what we're really tapping into is that like that demand for content that kids love and that parents approve of. And so we at Jam, we're building a deep library of video that is, you know, focused on topics that do just that. And we sell a subscription for access to it.
So I have three kids, and we had kicked the tires, like trying to do DIY stuff, and it didn't ever really catch on. But when you guys put out Jam, like that's the thing that stuck for them. So the, you know, that's the thing that we're like, you know, you have a limit on the amount of, say, iPad time you have, but you have no limit on the time that you can spend like in Jam, like learning new things. And that in and of itself, I think like the longer form, that format of just being very intentional about teaching, and then also like having this interactive portion where you have to like complete some sort of task or submit something or whatever, clicked really well for them. How do those two like coexist for you guys as a business, have DIY and Jam?
Yeah. So, DIY, you know, it continues to serve, you know, the sort of like community worldwide of schools and families that are really seeking a framework for learning skills. And so like, you know, we give all of it away for free. There's 140 different skills there. And if you want to know something, if a parent wants to teach a kid something, or if a kid is self-motivated, they can go to DIY and we basically just give them an outline of the things that they should try, and what we're to teach them what they need to know. We just find the best video we can find on the internet for each one of those challenges, because we believe that, like, you know, one of our theories is that the best teachers on earth aren't actually teachers. You know, they're people who are practicing these skills every day. They're passionate about them, and they're just really savvy at explaining these things. And they're probably like, there's some of them are probably building an audience around their passion using social media. So we go hunt them down on Instagram or YouTube or Vimeo, and we get permission to use their videos to teach these things to kids. But the videos are mostly short form, you know, like they're typically less than 5 minutes, and there's a ton of work that the kids or families or schools need to do on their own to sort of fill in the gaps to, like, you know, between watching that video and then like getting together what they need to do the project. And, Jam is a little bit more, focused on, we're focusing on a much fewer skills. So like less than 10, and we're going really deep on those topics and producing, you know, tens of hours per each topic, to cover every nook and cranny of the skill. So I would say that, like, you know, DIY is a self-serve kiosk model for, you know, for a basic framework, for learning lots of skills. I think it's like, I would call it like, it's great for explore mode, and Jam is, about, you know, is for kids that really want to deep dive on certain subjects.
What's the next sort of 6 to 12 months look like for you guys as a company?
Yeah. So, we started from, you know, we launched Jam 18 months ago, and we had this challenge where we had no video, and we needed to get some. So we needed to start charging for it. So our sort of rollout strategy was to build channel by channel and to sell access channel by channel. And for each one of those channels, we need to like pre-produce enough content that, like, so that when someone bought it, they would feel like they got their money's worth. And as of December, we felt like we had enough content across the entire library to begin selling all access subscriptions, so that, you know, with one subscription, you could access all the channels. And that's really been the sort of like business changer for us. That sort of merchandising model, that price point, the user experience is like what's like really clicked, and our business is beginning to grow proportionally. So now it's just about looking for scalable ways to continue adding original content to our library. What's cool is that, like, you know, we're doing it pretty well already. Netflix pays about $6,200 a minute for original content, and our like effective cost is about $60 per minute. So we're doing it pretty well. Part of that is driven by the fact that kids don't need, you know, famous actors, and they don't need, you know, very well written, like narrative driven dramas to be entertained. They basically sincerity and creativity are typically like all you really need to keep a kid engaged.
What do you, for you, I, to me, you think of something like, a College Humor, Busted Tees, Vimeo, like there are these really fun things to work on that obviously provide a lot of value. But then like compare that to something like DIY and Jam, where it's like, it feels to me like, I don't want to like put words in your mouth or say like life's work or anything like that, but it feels like the kind of thing that like you could cultivate and like work on for like decades to come. And I'm curious kind of how you view, DIY and Jam and sort of like the grand scheme of culture and like the impact it'll have.
Yeah. I mean, as I said earlier, I think like I'm still recreating that feeling I had when I was like an early user of AOL and I was giving away graphics for free and downloading other people's graphics for free. I have this indelible mark in me of like what the internet could be and what participation on the internet should be. And I am trying as hard as I can to keep myself attached to projects on the internet that are living up to that feeling trying to recreate that feeling. So that's, you know, from Vimeo to DIY to Jam, they are all thematic that way. And, sure, you know, autobiographical for that reason.
All right, man. I think that's all I got. We've covered a massive amount of stuff here. So, I appreciate you laying all this stuff out, and it was great talking to you. How can people get in touch?
Best place is to reach out on Twitter. My handle is Zach Klein.
All right, man. Well, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Josh.
All right, there we have it. Zach Klein of Vimeo and DIY. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I'd love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com, or on Twitter, @Spigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to lots of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes goes a long way. Thanks again, and see you next week.